I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. It's really good to be with you today. We're going to be having a very interesting conversation with someone who has deep knowledge, both from study, scholarly study, and from personal experience with American domestic policy. We're going to be talking particularly today about U.S. drug policy, the current situation and the prospects for reform. What's the current state? What should the situation be with U.S. drug policy? And for that conversation, we'll be talking with Carl Zinsmeister. Carl, well, is one of the leading thinkers on U.S. domestic policy. He's also one of the most important voices on U.S. philanthropy. It's been a subject to which he's devoted many years of his life, personally, professionally. If you're talking about strategists who really think about the importance of civil society and the institutions of civil society addressing social ills, Carl Zinsmeister is your man. He was chief domestic policy advisor and director of the White House Policy Council under President George W. Bush. So he's thought about these issues at the very highest level. But a real feature of Carl's work is thinking about things not from the top down, but from the grassroots up and from the institutions of civil society. So we're going to have a fascinating conversation today. Carl, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
You know, one thing I noticed is thinking about policy, you're not, of course, just a policy analyst. You're a writer, a prolific writer, author of many books, fantastic works, including a new one called The Brothers. And I think it's particularly pertinent for this conversation. It will be really interesting to our listeners. What's this new project that you've been working on?
Thanks for asking. It's an historical novel, and it's actually what got me writing about drug policy again. What was going on there, Jeff, was in Jacksonian America, you know, a couple centuries ago, really, at this point. But let's say when America was a teenage nation, if you will, early in our days as a country, we had lots and lots of social problems. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of violence on the streets within families, between conflicting political groups. There was serious social dysfunction of all sorts. There were lots of orphans and people living alone. Sex trafficking was a problem. There was a massive substance abuse problem. It wasn't drugs in those days. It was basically rot gut alcohol, but a very, very serious intoxication problem that was causing everything that always causes: crime, family abuse, work problems, violence. It's kind of eerie, kind of parallels to what we're experiencing today in terms of social disorder. And there's also another parallel that got me writing my book, got me writing this novel, The Brothers, which was that the government at that point was really dysfunctional. It was just really gridlocked. There was not a consensus. There was a massive party confrontation taking place. People couldn't agree. And so the government was really not solving problems. So you think, well, things just must not have gotten better. Actually, they got tremendously better over the course of basically one or two generations. And the way that happened is that people banded together in voluntary groups and said, we're sick and tired of X, Y, or Z problem, and we're going to fix this as a group. And that's something that Americans really do. I mean, this is something that struck the very earliest observers of America, like Tocqueville and Edmund Burke, who said, this isn't a country where they just, wait for the local lord to fix things or wait for the government or, to use a modern metaphor, we don't just dial 911. We actually go out and attack problems ourselves when we see them in our communities. And that's documentable. That as you mentioned, I've been very interested in philanthropy and civil society. So I've written a lot about how Americans fix public problems using private resources. So that's the kind of the background, Jeff. And so I wrote this book about these really fascinating true life brothers. About 95% of the book is actual direct history, even though I wrote it as a novel to try to bring it to life for modern readers. But these brothers got involved in a whole host of really nasty problems. They became most famous basically for their crusade against slavery. They were serious Christians and felt that on both religious grounds and American grounds, slavery was just, you know, a sin, literally a sin. And at that point, there were people who had the same feeling, but abolitionism, the movement to end slavery, was basically a fringe movement, really did not have a popular mass base, was considered kind of an extremist position, and people just couldn't quite figure out how to get out of this terrible box we were in. And these brothers began to band together again with their neighbors. They didn't go to the Senate and try to pass the law. They didn't, you know, beat on the president. They didn't lobby anybody. They just said, we need to talk about this as a nation and change people's minds. And so that's what they did. And they basically were the people who turned abolitionism, the movement to end slavery, into a mass popular movement, which made Lincoln possible and all kinds of other things. But in addition to that, these brothers, the Tappan brothers that I write the novel about, also attacked all kinds of other problems, public problems with private resources. And what got me writing about drugs, Jeff, was that, as I mentioned, there was a serious alcohol abuse problem. In fact, when I got into it, I just couldn't believe it. Would you believe that alcohol consumption per capita, according to census figures I discovered, was about 3 to 4 times our current level of consumption?
Wow.
Of alcohol. Really high. And it was included children, you know, all kinds of really bad uses and abuses of alcohol. And that meant that, you know, men were beating on their wives and wives were beating on their husbands and people were missing work and paychecks were evaporating and children were being neglected. All the stuff that happens when a able-bodied adult is intoxicated rather than cued into life. And this really broke a lot of people's hearts and got a lot of people agitated. And so the Tappan brothers, the heroes of my novel, among others, among lots of other people, decided we can work on this. We just have to start having a conversation. So they started what was called a temperance movement. And as the word temperance implies, they wanted to temper. They weren't looking to ban anything, but they said, we need to talk to people about all the harm that's being done here and how unnecessary it is and encourage people to live a different life. And that's what they did. And they started a whole series of like support groups, but also, you know, a popular movement. There were songs and parades and flags, and there were groups where you could go and have the kind of the warmth and fraternity that you get in a tavern without the alcohol. There was a very interesting and sophisticated public kind of culture crusade to fix the temperance problem. So, you know, as you mentioned, I'm a policy guy, and my heart has been broken. I hope a lot of other Americans' hearts have been broken by what's happening in drugs in this country. I mean, you know, if you don't have a family member or somebody who's been hurt by them, God bless you. But a lot of us have seen people just go down the hole, the black hole.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, we're here in North Central Ohio, and we've even had public officials come and ask them, you know, including one presidential candidate, who we asked, you know, what policy position have you changed? And his response is not so much changed, but now it's on my list of important policies, and that is the fentanyl crisis, which is a real powerful thing across the country, including here in Ohio. It's amazing that you've done that historical work and has prompted you to, as you say, to rethink or think again about U.S. drug policy. A lot of our listeners are very historically minded, as you know, but also interested in current public policy. I think we have some sense of the scope and depth and horror of the current drug epidemic in the United States, including things like fentanyl. What about contemporary U.S. drug policy? What's the state? What's the situation?
You know, it's a terrible self-inflicted wound. Drugs are always going to be with us. All right. It's one of those things that people use as a recourse to medicate themselves or to escape reality or just because they're incredibly irresponsible. Some people have mental illness problems and they use drugs to try to escape that and make things even worse. So I don't think anyone has any illusion that we're ever going to have a drug-free society. But there is an enormous range within which we can navigate to have a lot less drugs and a lot less damage done by them versus just saying, well, what will be, which is basically what we have said as a society over the last decade or two, where we've legalized things. We've literally said, we're going to stop even trying to suppress these substances. We're going to stop trying even to encourage people to step away from these. We're just going to let people make their own private decision. Of course, this is a private decision with all sorts of public ramifications in terms of people who then can't work, who don't take care of their families, who steal and commit crimes to support their habits. And you're seeing this. We're seeing this all over American cities, maybe most pronounced and horrifically and obviously in some of the West Coast cities. So I think most of our listeners probably are well aware of what's happening in Portland, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles. We have literally thousands of drug addicts living on the streets, shooting up in public, smoking in public, you know, tripping and screaming and hollering and being crazy in public, you know, defecating on the sidewalks, breaking into cars so they can buy the next fix. It has become really the root of a massive livability crisis in a lot of our cities. So one of the things that sparked me to write about this recently, Jeff, is the state of Oregon. So Oregon was one of the, were one of the leaders that, that their new policy, you ask about policy, their new policy was, well, you know, drugs are a private decision. And you know, the war on drugs was hard and harsh and it put people in jail and we don't like doing that. So let's just kind of back off and not enforce any laws against most drug use. So that's basically what the state of Oregon did. They started this in, I think late 2019 is when it actually went into effect, early 2020. And they basically decriminalized drug use. And the effects were almost instantly horrible. You had, in fact, I've got the numbers here. Let me just refer to them. So the state of Oregon had 610 people die of drug overdose in the year before they legalized. 3 years later, that number of annual deaths to overdose had tripled to 1,700 per year statewide. And that's just overdose death. Then there's the people getting car crashes or the people who use guns in crimes and kill someone or get killed. There are the children that get whacked and mistreated. So there's this whole kind of trickle-down horror effect of drug use. But in 3 years for anything to triple is kind of shocking for demographers and social theorists. And so there was this just massive miscalculation where people said drugs don't really hurt society. It's kind of an individual thing. And if they get in trouble, we'll help them with counseling. And everybody backed off and it was an absolute disaster. So the state of the people of Oregon are not fools. They woke up to this. And there was, over the last year or so, there's been a massive agitation. This was a goof. This was a terrible idea. We were sold a bill of goods by the progressives and others who said that drug use is not a place where the state should have any interference. And so there was about to be a massive, basically grassroots recall of this policy when the establishment, the political establishment in Oregon said, oops, we're about to get our fannies handed to us. We better do something about it before the people act on their own. So the governor kind of reluctantly and the legislature finally passed a bill to recriminalize drug use. But, you know, in the meantime, we had literally thousands of people die. And it wasn't just Oregon. I looked up the numbers. San Francisco, for instance, San Francisco, many of our listeners know, is a pretty small city. You know, population-wise, it's not one of our bigger cities. There are 800 people every year who die of drug overdose in San Francisco these days. Washington, D.C., which is another small city. I mean, not the suburbs, but the city proper is under a million people. And every single year, Washington, D.C. buries 630 people now just from drug overdose. And again, then there's the collateral effects. There's the crimes and the car crashes and things. So it's actually gotten to the point now, I'm sure you know, Jeff, where it's not only damaging specific neighborhoods and specific places, it's actually depressing the life expectancy of America as a whole. I mean, my whole lifetime, every year, life expectancy went up a little bit. And we kind of got used to the idea. That's what technology does. That's what new drugs do. I mean, life gets better. People live a little bit longer. And all of a sudden, a few years ago, we saw something we have never seen in the modern era, where life expectancy went down, actually fell. And it was mostly drug abuse that accounted for this. So it's been really a calamity. And the policy, like I say, has really been self-inflicted. We made so much progress during the 80s and 90s. There was just a really concerted effort to say drugs aren't victimless, actually. And we're gonna fight them with all the tools we have, including border interceptions and law enforcement crackdowns and going after dealers, but also including intensive counseling and going into grade schools and telling kids this is not something you want to do. And this whole panoply, this whole range of tools was going to be used. And we made tremendous progress. Drug use was a problem, as many of our listeners remember. The whole Len Bias, you know, situation was this very famous new NBA draft pick who overdosed on cocaine and died and kind of shocked a lot of people that this is how bad it has gotten. That, you know, a millionaire, a guy who had his whole life in front of him, basically perished. And it shocked people. And there was a backlash against that. And we set up a national drug enforcement policy in the White House, which I oversaw when I was there, among my other duties, and really made some tremendous progress in getting this under control. And then a kind of a new ideology took hold really within the last decade that said, again, this is a victimless crime, and all you're doing is putting people in jail who don't belong in jail, and marijuana never hurt anybody, and cocaine doesn't really hurt anybody. And a lot of myths were peddled, which have created really a disaster today that we needn't have had.
Yeah, can I ask a little bit more about that, the sort of decriminalization? As you say, it seems like a movement, even here in Ohio, recently a ballot initiative passed to decriminalize marijuana. It's happened in neighboring states like Michigan. And these are not states that that at least typically would associate with, you know, California or something like that, right? These are states right in the heartland. Can you talk a little bit more about what is behind the movement to, for example, decriminalize marijuana?
Oh, it's a playbook. I mean, there is a playbook out there. There are a group of people with funding by people like George Soros who decided that they didn't like the fact that there were a lot of drug dealers in prison, and they didn't like the fact that you know, there was a whole mechanism at the border that there were pressures on overseas countries like Colombia to try to reduce cultivation of drug producing plants. It was just a kind of a violation of a lot of the progressive ethics that said that this is something to just leave to people to decide. There's also just a huge illusion on the left, especially, but among, as you say, Jeff, among a lot of Americans, that drugs are just a recreation. They're just recreational. And that's really not accurate. Drugs have an ability to grab people by the throat and to addict and to make it impossible for many people to walk away. That makes it just completely foolish to say that this is the same as, you know, somebody who just wants to relax and it's nobody else's business. It actually becomes somebody else's business when they have all these overflow effects. So this is something that really started with a real concerted effort, has been carefully funded. There are groups that were set up. And as I say, one of the tragedies is that at the same time, this really stupid policy was blooming. The drugs themselves, as just chemical substances, were becoming calamitously more dangerous. And you mentioned fentanyl. Fentanyl basically is a substitute for heroin. It's massively more potent. It's massively more dangerous. It is killing thousands and thousands of people all the time. And it's not just fentanyl. Marijuana, you mentioned marijuana is another good example. I looked these stats up before we got together here. So the way that the potency of marijuana is measured is the main active ingredient is called THC. And the average THC potency number back in 1977 was 1%, right? Today, that exact same measure of the potency of the average marijuana in circulation today being used by consumers is 16%. You've had a 16-fold increase in the power and potency of this drug. You know, opioids are not stronger than they used to be, but they're vastly more available. They're in lots of people's medicine cabinets today. Again, there was a kind of a social decision that people shouldn't have to live with pain, and let's stop being such prudes about writing prescriptions, and let's just get them out there for anybody who needs them or wants them. Washington, D.C. actually had I couldn't believe when I used to walk around Washington a couple of years ago and see these posters on the on the telephone polls that said, you know, vote yes on referendum XYZ. I forget the number. They basically legalized hallucinogenic mushrooms and other things. Not only are these dangerous as addictive and mind-altering substances, but no one has a clue what the rest of the things that they do to you. Do they cause cancer? I don't know. I mean, putting tobacco smoke in your body turned out to be very dangerous as a cancer agent. I can't believe that smoking the leaves of marijuana plants or eating, you know, other hallucinogenic substances doesn't have collateral side effects. But people are just blind. They just don't even want to investigate this. And again, this is part of the ideology. Part of the ideology is that this is a recreation, basically, and not a public policy problem. And it's really misguided. And of course, the people who often pay the price are not the people who are most irresponsible. I mean, it's kids, for instance. I mean, there are just so many kids today who, first of all, are getting a lot of it in utero. We know that THC crosses the placenta easily. All right. So when a mom smokes marijuana, she is doping her child and changing his or her brain wiring. We have absolutely no question about that at this point. And it's certainly true of lots of other drugs as well. Children whose parents have consumed drugs come up with smaller head circumferences. All right. I mean, really kind of scary physiological changes take place when they're exposed as youngsters. And then after they're born, even if they weren't exposed in utero, they have less attentive parents. We've been seeing this plethora of stories about kids locked in cages or closed in cars or left for the weekend while mom goes to the casino or whatever. Those are usually drug abuse cases. That's usually what's going on there. And so you get this whole case, this whole set of victims who are paying the price for somebody else's irresponsibility. So that's why it becomes a social problem for all of us to be concerned about.
And you extend this to, I'm just thinking again, when you're talking about this larger critique of drug policy and decriminalization, you extend that critique not just as to hard drugs, so, you know, cocaine, heroin, fentanyl, but also what people call soft drugs, marijuana, for example. Is that a misnomer? Do you reject the distinction between soft drugs and hard drugs?
At this point, it's really an illusion. As I say, marijuana has been bred to become more potent. Right? This didn't just happen. That has been what the industry has been doing for the last 30 years. They've been making these plants more and more potent, having more and more of the psychoactive substances in them. And so, yeah, marijuana is a very dangerous substance at this point. It's by no means a kind of a harmless. It's not even close to alcohol. It's. I have some of these statistics. I don't want to bore your friends with our audience with too many numbers, but marijuana is much more addictive as just on comparative grounds than alcohol is. Marijuana is much more likely to cause psychosis, much more likely to cause schizophrenia. It rewires brains. It lingers in the brain, in the white fat in your brain, for months and months and months after you use it. Whereas alcohol is flushed out of the system much more quickly. Marijuana is not a categorically different product than any of these other drugs we're talking about. And so this is one of these horrible myths that's been promoted, is that it's just kind of a carefree thing. And part of it's based on just foolish comparison of what baby boomers remember in the 1970s as marijuana versus the very different product that exists today. But the other part of it is, as I say, it's a kind of an intentional forgetfulness, that just pretending that these kinds of decisions can and should be left to individuals, and that is somehow oppressive for the state to try to stop and reduce usage. Now, so what do progressives want America to be poisoned with drugs? No, of course not. I mean, most of them are not evil people, but they've made some terrible assumptions. And the kind of alternative that most of the and it isn't just a left-right thing. It's heavily on the left, but as you pointed out, it happens among many parts of our population. The alternative is that you should reduce the harm of drugs. That's the big mantra today, harm reduction. So you give out clean needles, so they aren't passing HIV to each other when they reuse needles. You put Narcan in every cop's pocket, and I've literally seen it on street corners in little boxes. And Narcan is basically a last resort product for taking somebody who's in the death throes of usually fentanyl use and starting their heart again, basically. You know, harm reduction is got all of these crazy, really kind of spooky aspects that you're making it easier and safer for people to abuse their bodies and abuse their minds, which is the reason we have people laying on the sidewalks, tripping and vomiting and really just making themselves and everyone around them miserable in the streets of San Francisco and Portland today. So, this is not kind of something that just snuck up on us, or this is not something that just the drug cartels imported over our borders and we couldn't have had anything to do with. We asked for a lot of this, I'm afraid. Now, the good news is, to not be too gloomy about this, is we can change our mind. We can change our mind tomorrow and do things differently and start stopping this at the border, being more aggressive about that, using police powers to try to stop the people who are making money off of this, using all sorts of interventions. For instance, it's criminal that somebody who is arrested 10 times in a row today in the streets of San Francisco and has drugs in their system every time is not required to go into drug treatment. Not asked, not mother may I, but as a requirement, as a kind of compensation for your repeated criminal behavior, you need to get clean. And we're going to help you get clean. And we're going to do that instead of putting you in prison, assuming you cooperate. But if you don't cooperate, you're going to jail, bud, and you'll get clean that way. And it's a lot less fun to withdraw in jail. So those are the kinds of hard choices we used to make and we've been unwilling to make. And it's really hurting even the victims, even the users of drugs, most of all, more than anyone, which is the real perversity of this.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi. This is John Moser, Chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Well, I was actually going to ask that question because one of the critiques that you know, certainly, of the idea of criminalization of drugs, including marijuana, is that nonviolent drug users end up in jail, and they shouldn't be in jail because they're not harming anybody else's life, liberty, or property. So why should they be in the same place where thieves or murderers are? How do you respond to that critique?
I'd love to see, you know, a parallel set of drug courts and perhaps drug incarceration policies and procedures that recognize that drug criminals, not the traffickers. I mean, the traffickers are just like any other criminal, most of them. They are doing something evil for money, and they will use violence whenever necessary to protect their financial stakes. But the users, there are actually good drug courts in existence today in a parallel structure, and we could have more of that. But at this point, there's not even an appetite for that. The demand really has been to just not enforce anything. And that is inhumane, as I think you just implied, to the drug user, him or herself. It just doesn't help that person. Most of those people, at some level, want to become clean and need help. And sometimes it's a shocking kind of help. It's very often a tough love that says, you must get treatment or you are going to face a criminal penalty. And I have no problem with that. You know, these are substances that, as I mentioned before, grab you by the throat. There is a physical, biochemical addiction process here that makes it very hard to walk away. I get that. And I don't think you should treat that person as just a bad human being. But I also don't think you should ignore the fact that they have a really egregious problem, which has all sorts of antisocial fallout. And you don't have to wait until the person becomes violent. I really reject the idea that the only reason for stopping drug use is if it leads to violence. again, we've learned that people lying on sidewalks, vomiting and twitching and freaking out and dying, even if the innocent person walking by isn't dying, is completely unnerving and unacceptable. I don't want to see someone die. It is very hard for me to step over someone on the sidewalk who's in a horrible state, and no citizen should be asked to live with that as an alternative. So there are a whole spectrum of ways that this becomes a problem for everybody.
Right. Well, as we know from studying American history, and as you portray in your novel, a lot of the counterattack against the scourge of alcohol that you're discussing came, as you said, from voluntary associations. Right. So I'm wondering if Carl Zinsmeister is looking at the possibilities for reform in America with respect to drugs, not only the policy reforms, but also the place of voluntary associations and civic organizations and the like in combating the scourge of drugs.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Jeff. So let's get right to the $64,000 question here. You know, a lot of what you hear when you talk to a drug legalizer is, oh, we tried that. It was called prohibition, and all it produced was Al Capone. All right, that's the really crude shorthand that you get is that temperance doesn't work. You know, prohibition doesn't work. You just got to let people do what they'll do. And that is just historically and factually so wrong. And we've allowed that lazy, easy kind of fiction to take root in everybody's minds. I mean, my mom thinks that. A lot of normal people think, oh, prohibition was a disaster. We don't want to try that with drugs, do we? Actually, that's completely false. So the temperance movement had a couple of phases. It started, as I say, with people like the people I wrote about in my book, who said, enough is enough. You know, my daughter was getting beaten up by her husband. My factory can't operate on Monday mornings because so many men are drunk. My children are not getting the attention they need from me because of my problem. So they said enough is enough. And there was a movement of citizens, almost entirely voluntary private groups. They were related to churches. They were related to workplaces. Unions sponsored these. There were separate groups for African-Americans, for sailors, everything you can think of. There's this big movement. They signed pledges. They found battle buddies to kind of support each other. As I say, there was this whole popular culture thing that went with it, where there were songs, lips that touch whiskey will never touch mine, sung by these beautiful women, you know, all kinds of funny, goofy, up and down, serious, not so serious efforts to support moderation and to encourage people to think twice. And this was massively successful. As I mentioned, the historic level of alcohol use at that time was 3 or 4 times the current level. When this temperance campaign started, that usage level went down, and it was eventually cut by 70%. So it was cut to essentially today's current level of consumption, which is a kind of a more of a baseline. And so people say, well, I thought that whole suppressing intoxicants was a failure. Well, there was a phase two, which was after the voluntary civil society driven private effort, then the government got involved. And the government passed a constitutional amendment and said, thou shalt not, period. And they used an entirely 100% law enforcement approach to prohibit, as prohibition implies, rather than to temper, meaning get people to voluntarily change their behavior. So what's happening today is people are confusing the government failure with the voluntary civil society triumph, and very sloppily and promiscuously kind of conflating these two and saying, oh, it's hopeless, give up, can't do anything about it. There's all kinds of things we can do about it. And one tool does need to be law enforcement. I mean, back to the temperance effort, they used the law. It wasn't the centerpiece of what cut alcohol use, but they used the law to moderate the location of saloons, to moderate the hours of saloons, to prohibit selling of alcohol to children, to prohibit, you know, extremely high proof mixes of alcohol, to do kind of those sorts of things. And we have to have a law enforcement effort as part of this. We have to get the Mexican cartels and the Chinese fentanyl producers to stop pumping this poison into our country. We have to get the gangsters who are peddling this at the street level off of the streets and behind bars. We have to get the people who are shooting each other to protect their turf behind bars. But that's not the first and foremost work. The first and foremost work is really to have this tempering effort, this voluntary effort, this private effort based in churches and unions and wherever else it will take root, to get people to step away from what most of them recognize is really a bad behavior, but they're not getting any support or encouragement today to step away. Everyone is saying, oh no, you're fine. You know, don't worry about it. That's just a bunch of prudes who are worried about drugs.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. What would a contemporary temperance movement look like with respect to drugs?
Well, I mean, it exists. Groups that, like Alcoholics Anonymous, that actually do the same thing for drugs. And frankly, they are the most effective. I mean, substance abuse treatment is a really difficult undertaking. Okay, let's say that right up front. It's a chemical thing. It gets into your brain. It rewires your body. It's very hard to step away from. You need a lot of help. And it's one of those areas in social policy where failure is more common than success. It's not the only area. I mean, like entrepreneurialism is another. People, I think a lot of our listeners realize that for every cool entrepreneurial little business that becomes Google, 10 or 100 fail. You know, so it's literally there are more failures than there are successes. Well, guess what? There are more failures in trying to step away from drugs and alcohol than there are successes. Most people, it takes 2, 3, 4 times sometimes before they finally sticks and they're able to put it behind them. And we have to sort of live with that and work with that and recognize that this isn't just like push a button, go in for 6 weeks and you're clean. It's gonna be that way for some people. And for other people, that might take 2 or 3 or 4 times. So you've got to have this whole range of things. You've got to have all kinds of support. You also have to have all kinds of pressure. You have to have people feel like if you don't succeed at this, you might lose custody of your children. You might lose your job. You might spend time behind bars. Bad things can happen. That's not the first, you know, step. The first step is to support and encourage and put arms around somebody. But there has to be this whole range of tough love. That's what most of these voluntary groups have found. And the other thing, Jeff, is that it's clear you can't drag someone into this. People have to be ready. They have to come basically with their own heart change. And they have to walk in the door and say, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Please help me. But you'd be amazed how many addicts are in that position. A lot of people are at that stage. They want help. And they usually it's precipitated by a crisis. Usually someone getting arrested is a great thing for most addicts. That is often like the precipitating event that just tips them over and says, all right, time for me to change. And so again, the enforcement and the support are kind of intertwined here, but it's, as I say, it's something where we don't have to completely reinvent the wheel. We did this in the 80s and 90s, as I say, with great effect. There was a massive drop. I mean, anybody who gets into this, who's listening, really wants to go look at the statistics, you'll see there was a gigantic fall off in drug use in the 80s and 90s. And so we have templates. We have things we can copy. We have things we can look at. We should certainly go back to Jacksonian America. I mean, read the brothers about how this was done with alcohol. And I think you'll find it very encouraging. I know I did. I was shocked and really encouraged to see that this is not just pie in the sky. You know, this is not, you know, a kind of wishful thinking. This is something that actually has happened.
I was wondering about that as you were talking about the brothers. Question was thinking, you know, in some ways the slavery, the voluntary associations did have this amazing effect in spreading temperance in the United States, as you say, and driving the use of alcohol down. On the other hand, the abolitionist movement did become a mass movement. It did agitate to end slavery, but of course slavery ends not because of the abolition movement, but because of the Civil War and legal means to end it. Yep. Are drugs more like alcohol or slavery?
That's a really great question, Jeff. You know, I think there is going to be, I don't think it will require, and please God, it won't, anything like the Civil War. It won't require anything like that level of mobilization. But you're right. Let's talk about slavery for a second. It eventually required massed armies, okay, and a lot of gunpowder and horrible violence to really put that behind us. But that never would have even been possible if you didn't have someone like Lincoln elected who said, this is so important. We have to do it. We can't just let a bunch of people, a bunch of states walk away and continue to run, you know, slaveocracies. That's not acceptable. And the only reason Lincoln was elected, and there was a mass, a sufficient, you know, kind of mass of people in this country that, again, got to the point where they said enough is enough, was because of this long civil society action. So you basically needed both tools, is what I'm saying. You needed the civil society action to prepare people's minds to say, if it takes bloodshed, we'll go there. We have to go there. This is a horrible abuse of human rights that can't continue. So you had to have that to prepare people. And then ultimately, you also had to have a horrible law enforcement action that really made this real. Now, as I say, I don't want to use that scary metaphor too much for drugs, because we don't need anything like that. It's not going to require a civil war to fix this. But I like the fact that that illustrates that you need both the carrot and the stick. And I think at some level, we need both carrots and sticks in our drug policy. We are certainly need to undo, and the people of Oregon just did it on their own, the crazy, foolish idea that there's no place for policing and law enforcement in drug control. There is a huge place for that. It has to be done. And we have to get back to it and be hard-headed about that. But I also don't think that should be the centerpiece. We are a republic where public opinion matters. And I think we have to get back to reminding people what they used to know, which is this is not a victimless thing. It's not victimless at all. And these are not just fun, you know, things to play with. That there are addictive potentials here, and that there are all sorts of collateral damages that make it relevant to each one of us. And that needs to be a conversation. So there need to be groups that talk about this in an intelligent way. And you're seeing some of this. I mean, there have been some very good books recently written about the damage done by marijuana and other drugs. They're beginning to be academics who are finally taking the time and effort to study the long-term effects of things like marijuana use. And they're saying, actually, it's not as benign and benevolent as you're being told. There are all sorts of problems. And as again, that's how we're discovering that schizophrenia and psychosis and permanent epigenetic changes that you can pass on to your children happen when you consume marijuana chronically for a period of time. That's pretty new research. And we need to do more of that. We need to have the tools that are necessary to have these conversations with people so they can realize that this is really not in anybody's interest.
Well, it's a fascinating argument. It's an interesting book. Again, let me commend to our listeners The Brothers by Carl Zinsmeister, a historically informed novel that does shed a lot of interesting light on the current discussion. And what a fascinating and provocative discussion. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Carl, on The American Idea.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.